Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Sam, host of Open World, formerly known as Against the Grain. I just got off the field, well, not even on the field. We're bailing ditches this weekend. And plan to start doing it this weekend, but we thought we'd get it done anyway because the RM came and cut a bunch of our grass because, you know, why not? So then we're going to turn that into bales. And it doesn't normally rain out at my place. Like, never, no busy right now, buddy. Doesn't normally rain out at my place. Never rains out at my place, actually. It's always like a running joke now that I never get any rain. But we happened to get rain in the middle of our baling operation, right as soon as we got the baler working. So that's kind of a pain in the butt. Because now it is so hot and it's beautiful. The sun is shining. There's a slight breeze. We should be out baling, but the grass is too wet. Because, you know, why not? No, busy right now, buddy. Daddy will be there in a sec. So the kids and their dad are going to be sitting in the pool. Here I am this evening, getting my radio show done. He's in there. He's in there. You're good. He's calling for you. He's calling for me, so you better get out there. Cool. What's up? This is Radio Show Home Life. Give me one sec here, guys. I'm going to plug in my headphones because I actually had a couple things I want to talk about. I have to find the book on my phone. So I started reading this book again. I read it the first few chapters before, but now I'm kind of digging a little deeper into it. It's called Deep Nutrition. Let's find the author. Just give me one second here. Plug in my headphones. There we go. You can hear me say, hey. If you can't, well, it's up for you. Alrighty. Break open my phone. Deep Nutrition by Catherine Shanahan. Why your genes need nutrition or whatever, traditional diet. Hold on, I'm gonna find which chapter I was reading here. Hold on. Greatest Gift, Dynamic Symmetry, Letting Your Body Create. Is this the one? Dangers of the Modern Diet. Great Nutrition Migration. Hold on here. I'm trying to find the chapter because I've just been listening to audiobooks. Hold on here. You say potato. Hold on, just going a little farther. Life in Outer Space. The Capu with Cholesterol Theory created a sickness epidemic. This is chapter 7. This is the book that I wanted to talk about, this chapter here. Specifically this chapter, talking about the fats and things. So, I'm an all-around health nut. I like health stuff. I like knowledge. I like traditional information, et cetera, et cetera. I had a theory the other day while I was listening to this book. I was in my garden. I was listening to this book. And I had a theory. We all know that they are working to depopulate this planet. Bill Gates has talked about it in his seminars. You could go, you know what, we're just going to go to Google right now. I'm gonna just pop open Google, and I'm going to show you. No, I don't want to save the password. We're good, buddy. Let's go to Google. And we're going to type in, we're just headed to google.com. We're going to type in depopulation. And we're going to type in news. Here we go. So look at this. You go to Google, right? You type in depopulation in the search bar. Then you click news. First article right here. First one. Understanding depopulation could be good for business. how understanding depopulation at scale could help businesses and investors identify opportunities and pursue pitfalls to avoid. But, like, a bunch of these articles, it's just, like, Spain welcomes immigrants in battle against depopulation. Japan will ignite the depopulation bomb. Like, a lot about Ukraine and depopulation. Oh, hold on. My computer froze up. Okay, here we go again. Dangers of depopulation with declining birth rates. That one's from DReset News from 3 weeks ago. Without enough Latvians, we won't be Latvia. Eastern Europeans shrinking population. That's from The Guardian, November 16, 2022. Population decline will change the world for the better. Scientific American, May 4, 2023. You notice how, like, if you actually, like, pay a little bit of attention to who's writing the articles, it's all about, like, business and especially science that's talking about depopulation being a good thing. It's all the conspiracy theorists, but, you know, the smaller articles, things like that, or, like, the mainstream news-ish. What the hell? Symposium explores psychological impacts of euthanasia depopulation. That's for the American Veterinary Medical Association. You know what? I'm going to have to take a look at that, but that looks really interesting. Water-based foam promise for method for swine depopulation to depop. Conspiracy, corona, chaos, coronavirus, Bill Gates, the UN, and population. Oh, that one's from January 17th, 2023. Most of this is talking about animals now, but the first page, it's all depop is good, depop is bad, depop is good. And if you've paid attention at all, over the past couple years, a lot of scientists, can't remember all of their names, but I know specifically, Geert Vandenbosch, that guy, looks like we need more water, that guy was working for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who just so happens to be in cahoots with the John Hopkins Society, because, you know, they're their biggest fans. This whole thing is just heavy and disappointing, and I'm tired today. I ain't gonna lie. I am beat and beat. A lot of scientists were talking about depop when it came to these mRNA injections. mRNA gene therapy. They're not vaccines. They're actually technically gene therapy. You can hit Google. You're going to have to forgive me. I'm eating a cookie because I'm hungry. You can hit Google and you can type in mRNA gene therapy, COVID, things like that. And there will be articles that pop up that specifically talk about gene therapy. I remember reading one a while ago, and I was talking about how asking if gene therapy, which was the mRNA vaccine, the COVID vaccine, was good for the population. Okay. Well. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh, look at this. Look at this amazingness. Oh. We can get back to the other stuff in a second. But I just went to Google, and I went to news, and I typed in gene therapy mRNA COVID. And the very first article that popped up from the Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, May 3rd, 2023, RNA therapies, small beginning to big opportunities. Second article from Nature, March 17th, 2023, mRNA therapy at the convergence of genetics and nanomedicine. Third one, Reuters. Moderna enters R&D collaboration for mRNA gene editing therapies. Ooh, that one was from February 2023. February 22nd, to be exact. Fourth one, Forbes. Moderna hopes to build on mRNA tech used in its COVID shots by targeting genetic diseases. Huh, interesting, hey? Eh? And then, of course, AP News. No, COVID-19 vaccines aren't gene therapy. Funny enough, but okay. Ah, that was a good cookie. Trash. Total trash. But... what the fuck is this? See, News Medical, mRNA medicine. What's next after the COVID-19 vaccine? American Journal of Managed Care, gene editing, mRNA hold promise as Fanconi anemia therapies. Like, you see this? Lipid particles could improve gene therapy for blindness. Using nanotechnologies that enabled mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccines, a new approach to gene therapy may improve how physicians treat inherited. Like, how the fuck? This is the word kind of play bullshit that they love to use on people. No, it's not a gene therapy, but all of these gene therapies that are based from the same technology that we use for the mRNA and the vaccines are now gene therapy. But that specific one, even though we're using the same shit, is not. Okay. If it's a duck, it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it's a fucking duck. Read time, 3 minutes. We're going to read this one from Technology Network's Biopharma. Using nanotechnology that enabled mRNA-based... Using nanotechnology that enabled mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccines, a new approach to gene therapy may improve how physicians treat inherited forms of blindness. A collaborative team of researchers with Oregon Health and Science University and Oregon State University have developed an approach that uses lipid nanoparticles, tiny lab-made balls of fat that deliver strands of messenger ribonucleic acid or mRNA inside the eye. To treat blindness, mRNA will be designed to create proteins that edit vision-harming gene mutations. In a study published in Science Advances, the team demonstrates how its lipid nanoparticle delivery system targets light-sensitive cells in the eye, called photoreceptors, in both mice and non-human primates. The system's nanoparticles are coated with a peptide that the researchers identified as being attracted to photoreceptors. Ah, go to hell. I don't want that. Our peptide is like a zip code, and the lipid nanoparticles are similar to an envelope that sends gene therapy in the mail, explained the study's corresponding author, Yuray Sahe, PhD, an associate professor in the OSU College of Pharmacy, who also has a joint research appointment at the OHI Institute. The peptide ensures mRNA is precisely delivered to the photoreceptors, cells that we haven't been able to target with lipid nanoparticles until now. More than 250 genetic mutations have been linked to inherited retinal diseases, but only one has an approved gene therapy, added study co-author Renee Riles, PhD. An assistant professor at ophthalmology at the OHSU School of Medicine and a scientist at OHSU KCI Institute. Improving the technology used for gene therapy can provide more treatment options to prevent blindness. Our study's findings show that lipid nanoparticles could help us do just that. In 2017, the Food and Drug Administration approved the gene therapy to treat an inherited form of blindness. Many patients have experienced improved vision and have been spared blindness after receiving the therapy, which is sold under the brand name Luxturna, L-U-X-T-U-R-N-A. It uses a modified version of the adeno-associated virus, or AAV, to deliver gene-revising molecules. Today's gene therapies largely rely on AAV, but it has some limitations. The virus is relatively small and can't physically contain gene-editing machinery for some complex mutations. AAV-based gene therapy can only deliver DNA, which results in continual creation of gene-editing molecules that may lead to unintended genetic edits. Lipid nanoparticles are a promising alternative because they don't have size constraints like AAV. Additionally, lipid nanoparticles can deliver mRNA, which only keeps gene editing machinery active for a short period of time, so could prevent off-target edits. The potential of lipid nanoparticles was further proved by the success of mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccines, which use lipid nanoparticles to deliver mRNA. They were also the first vaccines to be authorized for COVID-19 in the United States, thanks to the speed and volume at which they were manufactured. Well, yeah, because they got started on this shit in 2019. But that's besides the point. You notice how they're talking about these gene therapies when it comes to the eyeball using the exact same technology? I mean, this article literally admits that they use the exact same technology, which also, COVID-19 vaccines, which also use lipid nanoparticles to deliver mRNA. Jeez, what a coincidence, hey? But totally not a gene therapy, though. You can just read right between the lines right there. But the way they gaslight the shit out of you, don't ever let them gaslight you on this stuff. They say you're too stupid, but you know what? They play this trickery, foolery, tomfoolery, total nonsense. And they do this shit in medicine and law all the time. They get you with silly shit because they are master manipulators, but you're too dumb to know anything. Yeah, sure. In this study, Sahay Riles and colleagues demonstrated that a peptide-covered lipid nanoparticle shell can be directed towards photoreceptor cells in the retina tissue in the back of the eye that enables sight. At first, proof of concept mRNA with instructions to make green fluorescent protein was placed inside nanoparticles. Green fluorescent protein? Holy fuck, we're going to make people's eyes glow? Watch, people's eyes are going to start blowing out of their head next. How much you want to bet? Everybody's just going to start getting bleeding eyes, and their eyes are going to, like, pop. It's going to be bad. Anyway, after injecting this nanoparticle-based gene therapy model into the eyes of mice and non-humans, the research team used a variety of imaging techniques to examine treated eyes. The animal's retinal tissue grows green, illustrating that the lipid nanoparticle shell reached photoreceptors and that the mRNA it delivered successfully entered the retina and created green fluorescent protein. This research marks the first time that lipid nanoparticles are known to have targeted photoreceptors in a non-human primate. The scientists are currently working on a follow-up research to quantify how much of the green fluorescent protein is expressed in animal retinal models. They're also working to develop a therapy with mRNA that carried the code for gene editing molecules. I mean, it's right there, folks. They literally just told you that the COVID-19 vaccine isn't a vaccine, it's a gene therapy, without telling you that it's a gene therapy. So therefore, they have plausible deniability when you put two and two together and you see it walking like a duck and it's quacking like a duck and you say, hey, look, that's a duck. And they're like, no, that's a chicken. That's a chicken. And you're like, I'm pretty sure it's a fucking duck. And they're like, no, that's a chicken. We classified it as a chicken. But it's hanging out with all the other ducks. And it's making babies with all the other ducks. No, that's still a chicken. There, that's where they got you. That's where they got you. And they, according to them, you're too stupid to know that it's a duck. And they admit it without admitting it. This is how they get you. Anyway. So, with this COVID-19 vaccine, I had some thoughts the other day while I was watering my garden. I was listening to this book because you guys know how passionate I am about permaculture and sustainable farming and organic small growing and going back to foraging and things and making sure that we're really taking care of the land while we are living on this planet. If we are meant to be the stewards of this planet and we're supposed to be looking after it, we are not doing a very good job. We are very much not. And a lot of us think that we're doing a good job by having, like, not fluorescent light bulbs or whatever the hell, having LED light bulbs and turning off the lights at the end of the day. Well, guess what? There's more to it than that. And if you think that that's where it ends, is putting some recyclables in the recycling bin and turning off your lights and, you know, things like those little things like that, sure, it helps. I'm not going to say that it doesn't help. But in the grand scheme of things, I'm sorry, but you're not doing fuck all. And going back to the whole Depop thing, because like I said, they're working on Depop. They've been working on Depop for a while, and they're not hiding it. They're not hiding it. They're not telling. See, this is the crazy thing about the depopulation agenda, is when you go back to Google and you're looking at Google, you'll notice two themes. Every time you look up depopulation, you'll look up and it'll say that depopulation is a good thing, that it's good for the planet, it's good for business, it's good for this, it's good for that. Or you'll notice that it says that it's bad for the planet. It'll say it's not even bad for the planet. They won't say it's bad for the planet. They'll say it's bad for economics. So the only thing they say it's good for is economics, and the good thing about depop is like it's good for everything. But you'll also notice when they say also that it's bad for economics, you'll never see, in general, at least from my observations anyway, I could be incorrect, but from my personal observations, even looking at page one of the Google, the search for the radio show today, you'll notice that they say it's good for the economy or it's bad for the economy, we need to bring in more immigrants, especially in the first world countries, which are now slowly but rapidly becoming the third world countries. So places like the United States, like there was that article about Brazil, we need to bring in immigrants. Canada, the UK, all these places, are now no longer going to be in the very near future, first world countries, they keep talking about rather than the people that are there having babies, they always talk about bringing in immigrants. And if you pay attention, you'll notice that that's the common theme over and over and over again. So us here in Canada, the Crown came over and they decided to make these buck-ass treaties with the Indigenous people, and half the Indigenous people could actually understand the treaties and they could, you know, make a good wager, you know, make a good deal that they're going to be taken care of. And the other half couldn't speak any English, and they didn't understand. And they expected the Crown to abide by the treaties, and obviously the Crown hasn't. How these people haven't kicked the Crown out by now is just so fucking beyond me. Like, excuse my language, but, like, when you're supposed to be making a treaty with another country, and they're supposed to be looking after you, and not only do they not look after you, they stick you and all your people on these little reserves. They have passports, and you can say that's fake all you want, but guess what? In Canada, guys, they had the pass system. You were not allowed to leave the reserve without the reserve guy, whatever his name was. Let me see. I'm just going to Google it so I can get the proper terminology here, because it's all in my head, but it ain't coming out of my mouth. Let me hit Google here quick. This is why it'd be nice if I had live video. Pass system reserve Canada. Pass system in Canada. Here, we're going to the Canadian Encyclopedia. We're going straight into the fucking heart of the beast. No, go down. Okay, so let me give you a history lesson, guys, because this was ugly. This was ugly. And most people don't know about this. The overwhelming majority, especially Canadians outside of Canada, most people don't know about this. But Canadians, most Canadians aren't even familiar with this. Here we go. Pass system in Canada. This is from the CanadianEncyclopedia.ca. After 1885, Northwest Resistance, also known as the Northwest Rebellion, the federal government developed a pass system, a process by which Indigenous people had to present a travel document authorized by an Indian agent in order to leave and return to their reserves. Yes, you heard that right. Your vaccine passes, they had to have one to leave the flipping reserve. And they had to be back by a certain time. They needed permission of when they were leaving and when they're, it was like being on curfew. It was being on curfew simply for being indigenous. Isn't that amazing? So when we tell you that history is repeating ourselves, and when we tell you the indigenous people have already experienced all of this in Canada, and people don't want to listen, yeah, there's a reason why a good portion of them didn't want that bloody vaccine. There's a good reason for that, because of shit like this. The pass system was a way of controlling the movement of Indigenous people. It aimed to prevent large gatherings seen by many white settlers as a threat to their settlements. Not the Ukrainians, though. Just a fun fact. It wasn't the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians and the Indigenous people got along really well, because guess what? The Ukrainians were also seen as subhuman on Canada, too. So for everybody that's talking about, you know, all white people got privilege, fuck your hat. Because guess what? When you look at things like the Sterilization Act in Alberta and BC, guess what? The Indigenous people, they got sterilized first and the most. You know who was sterilized second and the most? The Ukrainians. And guess what? They're considered white. But there's a fun fact in racism for you. Oh, and they also nailed a bunch of the Greek Orthodox and things like that, too. But you don't want to hear that. Because guess what? Canada was not nice to a lot of people. They weren't nice to the Chinese people. They weren't nice to the Pakistani people and the East Indian people. They weren't nice to the Slavic people. Very much were not nice to the Japanese people. They weren't nice to a lot of people. You got a lot more privileges as a British or French or German or things like that than you did if you were a Slav or any other culture up here. But you know what? It's okay, because, you know, you get those privileges now, so whatever. Where was I? Colonial officials also believe that the pass system would prevent another conflict like the Northwest Resistance. Mm-hmm, sure. Used in conjunction with policies such as the Indian Act and residential schools, the pass system was part of an overall policy of assimilation. Though it never became a law, the pass system restricted Indigenous freedom in the Prairie West during the late 19th and earliest 20th centuries. It had lasting impacts on generations of Indigenous people, as restrictions on mobility caused damage to an Indigenous economies, cultures, and societies. I'd say. In the 1880s, the Northwest Mounted Police, NWMP, used vagrancy laws to restrict the movement of Indigenous people. They feared Indigenous people might attack the United States Army from Canada, or that Indigenous people on both sides of the border might form an alliance against the government. I kind of wish they would have. You know, it's like Canada was so smart on a lot of these things where they just used paperwork to trick these people and to screw them over. What you doing, Tiny? What are you looking for? Helios. Okay. Dinkles. He's got a little bird called Mr. Dinkles. If you watch the Trolls movie, it's that little worm on the Trolls movie. That's what they called this little bitty bird toy thing. Anyway. Colonial officials also believed that large congregations of Indigenous people threatened the peace and stability of white settlements in the West. Such large gatherings also allowed for the practice of Indigenous customs and religions, which were considered counterproductive to assimilation efforts. In 1882, the federal government passed an order in council that proposed authorities from both Canada and the United States grant permits to Indigenous people who wish to cross the border. In the same year, NWMP Commissioner Acheon Gosford Irvine recommended that Indian agents, the administrators of Indigenous policy, prevent large groups from leaving the reserves. Jeez. You know, you're going to be putting two and two together listening to this, and when you start researching what Canada did to the Indigenous, I mean, the United States, they just went in and, like, shot them all and fought with them. Canada was so cunning, and they were so unreal. They're like, half of the shit that they did with the Indigenous people isn't even ratified, but they still, by de facto powers, were able to mind control and muscle these people into total subservience anyway. The more you research what Canada did to the Indigenous people here, the more it's going to open your eyes on the kind of experiment and a kind of control that they've used on Canada again. If they can do it to the Indigenous people, don't think they'll ever stop with any other color, culture, or race. Sex, it don't matter. They won't stop. Okay. And by 1883, the Federal Department of Indian Affairs was also concerned about the movement of Indigenous women. In particular, camps and teepees on the outskirts of white settlements likely maintaining the home while men were away, Indigenous women were considered threats to colonialists. Deputy Superintendent General Lawrence Van Gonet suggested a solution. Indian agents issued teepee owners a permit that would have to be produced if requested by the police. Indian Commissioner Edgar Dooney suggested the police to use the Vagrant Act to remove individuals who camped without passes. You see that? They took something that was totally, completely lawful. Then they brought in permits to beg for permission. Because you're no longer qualified to do these things on your own. And then they use their legislations to remove you if they don't grant you a permit. Do you see this kind of shit that they pull? Do you see this? Do you see the mind trickery that they pull on you? That what you can do is completely lawful. It's not actually causing anybody harm. But they make you suddenly beg for permission because you're not qualified to do these things on their own, and then they can pull your permit at any time using their legislation magic trickery. Do you see that? Did you just fucking read what I read? Because, like, I'm sitting here looking at this, and I can't help but think to myself, like, how can the average common Joe, doesn't matter the color or creed, how can you not look at this and see how they get you? They put it in black and white. Right there. It's right there. And people yet scream from the rooftops about how this needs to be licensed and the government needs to regulate this and the government needs to that. Are you people insane? Sorry for being so salty today, you guys, but I can't help but look at this, and I can't help but read this, and I can't help but smash my head into the wall at how anybody, two brain cells left to rub together, could read this and think to themselves, maybe I do want my government crawling up my ass just a little bit more. Maybe I want that, because maybe my bowels haven't been tickled enough by their fuckery. Like, I can't help but just think to myself, how much of dross are these people are? Like, usually I'm a lot more cultured in my language outside of a couple of F-bombs and S-bombs here or there. But, like, it just makes me want to smash my head in a wall. Like, no joke, you guys. It makes me just want to just end myself. Not even kidding. Like, I just don't even want to be here anymore. When I sit here and I look at things like this, and I speak to the average Joe, and they sit there and, oh, this and that, but what about this? Oh, but, it's just, the excuses is just absolutely mind-blowing. It's insane. It's just absolutely crazy. Like, I'm just speaking off the cuff of my shoulder here, and I know this isn't exactly appropriate, but right now, I couldn't give two flips. Unbelievably insane. Let's continue, because the more, if you've got any sort of brain left in your head, which most people don't, although, I'm not going to lie, I am happy with the amount of people that are starting to put two to two together. However, the amount of people that lack a pair of balls because of the feminization of society and that we need to not hurt anybody else's feelings, you know, it's like, and this is why I'm kind of not even really caring so much that people are starting to bite back with the cancel culture crap, that people are starting to not care anymore. If they're just going to say what they're going to say, rude and crude and whatever they want to say. On one hand, yeah, sure, it's kind of annoying. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes it's a little frustrating or it's a little out of touch where it's like, you know, sometimes you're going a little off the handle. And as long as you understand and recognize that, you know what, you might not have the audience that you seek then if you're going to go off the handle like that. Like, I know, like, I swear on my show quite a bit. I share quite a bit in real life, and people tell me all the time, well, you know what, if you would quit swearing, more people would listen to your message. And I get that, and I understand that. And I can appreciate that point of view. But my message isn't for everybody, to be quite frank. My message is not for everybody. To be honest, I don't care. Because I used to cater to a lot of people. I used to want to be liked by absolutely everybody. And after being bit over and over and over again and getting fucked over by people over and over and over again, especially people who used pretty language and expected me to act a certain way around them, and then when I couldn't hold myself to an unrealistic standard that they had, they dropped me like a bowling ball. That was it. They dropped me and they didn't look back. And I don't care. If you don't like the way I speak on my show, you can kindly just fuck off. That's all I'm going to say. This is not going to be a very happy, peacetime, fun-loving show today. You know, I'm kind of salty. I'm not going to lie, because reading these kinds of things make me a little upset. Because the average Joe can read this and somehow it goes in one ear and out the other, and then they continue to burn their eyes out on the TV like a bunch of zombies. They just sit there and melt their minds. But I'm over here melting my mind with how ignorant can people be, but yet they want to sit there and call you ignorant because you refuse to stroke their turtle self-ego. Thank you, but no thank you. I'm over it. So moving on. After my little rant. Oh. However, Commissioner Irvine and the NWMP argued in 1884 that a policy of confining Indigenous people to the reserves would be viewed as a breach of confidence. Mm-hmm. Indigenous people had signed various treaties with the Crown, many of which confirmed the right to hunt and travel freely. See also number treaties. Since there was no federally approved past system at the time, the regulation of Indigenous movement was largely left up to the discretion of local authorities such as Indian agents and the NWMP. So in other words, the provinces did this kind of silly nonsense. Implementation of the past system. The Northwest Rebellion, or Northwest Resistance, of 1885 altered the government's approach to Indigenous mobility. With the rebellion underway, federal officials sought a more clearly defined, wide-reaching policy of restricting Indigenous movement. In May 1885, Major General Frederick Dobson Middleton wrote to Indian Commissioner Edgar Dewdney, suggesting colonial officials prevent Indigenous people from leaving the reserves in the hopes of stopping them from joining the conflict. Dewdney responded, indicating that he did not have the authority to issue such a proclamation. Nevertheless, he told Indigenous people not to leave the reserves without permission. The idea of a formalized past system was born. You see that? Dee, 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 dee. And just like that, even though it wasn't legal, they turned around and started to make it legal. Wow! In July 1885, a month after the conflict ended, Hayter Reed, Assistant Commissioner of Indian Affairs, penned a memo commonly known as the Memorandum on the Future Management of Indians, which influenced Indian policy at the time and included what became the past system. He submitted the memo to Dewdney, who approved of it. Dewdney then forwarded to the memo of Vangognet, who forwarded it to John A. Macdonald, the Prime Minister and Superintendent General of Indian Affairs at the time. However, Reed did not wait for the Macdonald's response, which eventually came way by Vangognet in October 1885, before implementing the past system in August of that year. Reed admitted to Dewdney that he was aware his policy was not supported by any law, but that his actions were justifiable because they were for the greater good. Can we read that again, ladies and gentlemen? Reed admitted the duty that he was aware this policy was not supported by any law, but that his actions were justifiable because they were for the greater good. What you doing, bud? We're going to take a quick commercial break. I just realized I've been rambling on for over 45 minutes. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to keep going over this, because you guys need to hear these things, and you guys need to start researching these things, and today on that show, we are going to go over those things. So we will be back in about 5 minutes.
Peter, the Korean films are my letter of recommendation.
Paul, where is your letter of recommendation?
Peter, the Corinthians' hearts are my letter.
Paul, that is utter bull malarkey. Daniel 11:32 through 36 warned us of the one who will deceive with flattery, saying that we are free from the law. There is a Freedomizer broadcast called from noon to 3 p.m. Pacific, 1 to 4 Mountain, and 2 to 5 Central every Saturday. Join Rachel Hodge 3 to 6 Eastern Saturdays by calling 319-BOX.
Sometimes as a Christian, it can be really hard to continue to find joy in our daily disciplines, even in biblical word Bible study. Honestly, we know we're supposed to find joy in it and get growth. That's why I named my new show Dynamic Word Bible Study. Studying the Word shouldn't leave you unchanged. It should provide dynamic growth through your life and the power of God encountered every day. I'm really excited to start this on Wednesdays from 9 to 10:30 right here on Freedomizer Radio. We're going to start out with the Book of Romans, one of the most important books to my early Christian walk. So whether you've been a Christian for a long time, or you're just learning about Scripture, this is going to be a great place to learn what it was that Paul was trying to tell the Church of Romans and the things that are important to us still today. Again, join me every Wednesday from 9 to 10:30 right here on Freedomizer Radio for Dynamic Word Bible.
Please check out the Proof Negative Radio Show Monday through Thursday, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. That is 6 to 9 p.m. on the Pacific Coast, with excellent co-host, outstanding guests, and lots of great conversation. We can even take your calls. The number is 319-527-6208, and just press lucky number 1, and you will be on the Proof Negative radio show.
Holy hell, scrap that. So, I don't know what's going on my end, but commercials loud and crackly. It might just be my phone today. I'm not sure. I'm going to save my ears. Just give me one sec. I'll move to my room here in a minute, guys. Give me one sec here, guys. I'm just letting the radio guy know that the commercials are acting funny, so we got to sort that out here. Not sure where the muscle check is here. Kiddo, give me one sec. Muscle check is by the microwave. Get your daddy to put some on your shoulder.
And for you.
Yeah, okay. All right, we're gonna take this operation. We're going to move it to my room because my little monsters have decided to come in here. And if we want to continue having a radio show today, we're going to move to a different location in the house. Oh, my goodness, your YouTubes. We're going to die without YouTubes. Whoops, almost got my phone snagged. 2 seconds here, guys. We are moving operations to a different part of my house. If I don't wreck my computer, I keep getting hooked on everything. Okay. One. Get some sunlight in here. We just had solstice not too long ago, which is pretty exciting. Okay, hold on. Let me grab my cable here and my phone. Here we go. Joys of having live radio with little kids. And no babysitter. A couple years ago when I was on Freedomizer, I would head over to my parents' place and they would watch my little monsters. But since then, things have changed. My dad has died, so my mom is busy often. And as of right now, I really have no car. So, sucks, man. I don't recommend your dad dying. Unless, of course, you and your dad don't have a good relationship, in which case, you know what, things happen. But, you know, kind of a crappy part of life. It is what it is, though. So, okay, let me get set up on the floor here. Oh, thank you, floor. It's cold on my floor. Okay, hopefully you guys can hear me. Oh, my goodness. Okay, there we go. Continuing on. Although the Prime Minister endorsed the past system, it was never enacted as a matter of law. Rather, the system was accepted and applied for its perceived usefulness to colonizers. Such a system, Reid and his contemporaries believed, would prevent another rebellion and support a policy of assimilation. In 1886, various Indian agencies received books containing passes. In order for an indigenous person to leave the reserve, they now needed a pass signed by the indigenous agents, Indian agents, stating they could leave, where they could go, and when they had to return. Obtaining a permit was not an easy task. Depending on the size of the Indian agencies and on the location reserved, individuals would often have to travel long distances to the agent's house to obtain a pass. Oh, and they didn't have cars. They'd have to walk. And they were lucky if they had a horse, but they probably had to walk. There was no guarantee that the Indian agent would be present when they arrived or that they would approve the request. If the agent was away, there were a few options beyond waiting or returning home. If a person left the reserve without permission and was caught by police, they would be arrested and brought back to the reserve. Beautiful. Beautiful. And then we wonder why the indigenous people are so fucking cranky, hey? We can't sit here but wonder why they're so mad and they want land back. Well, I mean, they did this. They put them on reserves. Then they went ahead and they put them in residential schools. When that didn't work, they did the six. When that didn't work, they started stealing their kids and putting them in the foster care system. Did you know that in Saskatchewan, like 95% of kids in the foster care system are indigenous? Or is it 85? It's 85. 85% of the kids in Saskatchewan are indigenous in the foster care system. 95% of people in jail are indigenous. Jeez. Interesting, isn't that? Moving on. Losing the freedom of unrestricted travel impacted various aspects of daily life. In terms of economics, restrictions on mobility limited what types of good indigenous farmers could sell at the market and where they could sell their food. Sellers of produce required not only a pass to leave the reserve, but also a permit to sell that food. While the pass system regulated the mobility of people, the permit system, also used in the 1880s until it was removed by the Indian Act in 1995. In 1995! You needed a permit to sell your stuff until 1995! Holy crap, I was born in 91, you guys! I'm 32! Wow! Even I didn't know that. Regulated the sale of goods off reserves. Holy smokes. Whole. But just get over it, hey? Just get over it. Sure. Delays in getting passes and permits could result in spoiling of produce and therefore loss of income. Coupled with agriculture policies that typically valued white farmers over their indigenous counterparts, again, unless you were Ukrainian, but whatever. For example, the peasant farm policy in 1989 to 97! prohibited indigenous farmers from using mechanized farm equipment, therefore limiting what they could produce. The pass and permit system stifled agricultural potential and damaged indigenous economies. But then we wonder why they're all sitting on the reserves, hopped up on meth. Geez, I wonder why. I wonder why. I mean, we could go off on the victim road, and then we could go off on healing, and, you know, these policies are gone, but the effects are lasting, but we need to start picking things up, and we need to start moving forward. But then you can't help but sit here and look at this and wonder, well, geez, I wonder how these people got to this position in the first place. I wonder how they sit around and twiddle their thumbs and why they feel so victimized. Because when they tried to actually do anything, they actually had legitimate racist policies put in place, which kept them down. And I know the United States just got rid of their affirmation entrances or whatever. You can't just be included or accepted in the universities and things simply based on your skin color. They got rid of that because it's unconstitutional. And, you know, I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. Because I don't think we should have ever had policies put in place to begin with that just limited people with their skin colors. You know, we talk about racism and things like that, and we are going to get back to my theory and stuff here in a minute. But we talk about things like racism, and we talk about things like inequality, and then, like, you know, this is the things that the lefties screech about. You know, this is the things, and this actually makes sense. When you actually look at these policies put in place that are gone now, thankfully they're gone now. But not only do we have to try and bring these people up to speed that have gone through hell and back and were forced to be put down by the system that they couldn't actually get anywhere because it was legislative. And that's the worst part, is like a lot of this wasn't even like legislative. It was just them doing what they wanted to do. Canada apparently has a really long-term streak of just doing whatever the fuck they want, regardless of the rules. Care. This is what, it makes me laugh when people are like, oh, the Canadian government can't or wouldn't do that. Ask the Indigenous people how much you think that the government is the good guy. Please, please ask them. Or just hit up Google. This is on the Canadian Encyclopedia, folks. This is on a government website. They flat out state to you that they never actually got any sort of formal permission to do this. They just did it anyway. It's all de facto. It doesn't have to be de jure. It's all de facto. They don't give a fuck. Oh my gosh. 97. 97, they weren't even allowed to use mechanized farm equipment. Wow. Just mind-blowing. Continuing on. The past system also prevented the practice of various cultural and spiritual activities by stopping people from traveling to participate in them. Oh, and by the way, on top of that, it wouldn't let you practice on your own reserve either. The only reason a lot of these indigenous spirituality information, this knowledge, this wisdom has been passed down because a lot of these people are resilient and they practice in their own houses quietly. They never let them beat this down. When we were having Christmases with family on farms or behind closed windows and we were being secret about it, that's what the indigenous people were doing. I mean, can you imagine not being able to go to church on Sunday? If you have, you know, if you go to church or if you're Muslim and you go to whatever practice it is there, or Buddhist or blah, 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 or anything, like you just get together and you guys read a holy book. I don't really care what it is. But you have your, or let's say you're not allowed to get together to do yoga with your homies. You know, we get together and we practice yoga. Well, yeah, that's not allowed anymore because that's a spiritual practice. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine not being able to do that anymore? Or if you're Christian, not being able to get together on Sundays and read your Bible. Like, can you imagine that? Because that's what these people went through. Like, just put yourself in their shoes for 1 minute and realize how messed up this is. And that we just went through that. Geez, now we wonder why everybody's so cranky? Then we wonder why everybody's so messed up right now? Well, yeah, because we got a taste of what they had for years. This shit sucks. this sucks. Not being able to have the freedom of being able to say what you want to say, not being able to have the freedom to do what you want to do so long as it doesn't actually harm anybody else. We're talking about objectively here. We're not talking about subjective. We're talking about being able to go out and hang out with your friend or sleep with whoever you want to sleep with or practice whatever religious practice you want to do, so as long as you're not cutting people's heads off, blowing people up, or things like that. It's just like, not that hard. Just mind your own business and then look out for one another. But we've lost that, and people got a taste of what these people went through for years. The past has been helped to enforce laws such as the Indian Act, which outlaws ceremonies like the potlatch and the Sundance. While these traditions have survived to the modern day, the past system and other policies of assimilation have worked their road and, in some cases, to eradicate various aspects of indigenous culture. Family life was similarly altered due to this period. If family members did not live on the same reserve, traveling to see them became more difficult. The past system also discouraged and sometimes prevented parents from visiting their children at residential schools. This has had intergenerational effects on families and communities who were disconnected from one another for years. This was genocide. That's what it was. The past system also segregated indigenous people from non-indigenous people in areas off reserves, arguably contributing to feelings of mistrust as well as socioeconomic inequalities between the two groups. Though some indigenous people living under the past system made attempts to resist their oppression, it was difficult undertaking the potentially serious consequences. Indian agents held a lot of power over indigenous communities, and many indigenous people were therefore afraid of challenging the agents' authority. Indigenous people also had little relative political power at the time. They were only able to become full citizens in 1960, the same year status Indian people could vote federally. Women got to vote before indigenous men did. You know that? Women got to vote before indigenous men did. On a number of occasions after 1886, the NWMP questioned the use of the past system because it was not enforceable under law. Oh, wow. In 1893, NWMP Commissioner Lawrence Herchmer ordered members of the force to stop returning people without passes to the reserve. Hayter Reed disagreed with Herchmer and ordered that the system continue to be enforced, even though he admitted again there was no law compelling indigenous people to remain on the reserves. Reed even suggested that officials keep this back from indigenous people as long as they could. In a letter to the Deputy and Superintendent General of Indian Affairs on 14th of June, 1893, Reed said, "If the police are unable to do anything more than request Indians to return to their reserves, then it would be better for them to abstain from doing that, since it will only draw the Indians' notice to and emphasize the fact that the police are powerless to enforce the request. Had the order been kept quiet, the Indians might have remained for some time in ignorance. But as I have already seen references to it in the public press, no expectation of withholding it from them need now be entertained." The past system remained in effect in various locations and in various degrees of enforcement until it was phased out in the 1930s. There is some evidence to suggest it was still being enforced in the early 1940s in some isolated areas. The past system has had lasting effects on generations of indigenous people. Over half a century of segregation and restrictions on mobility contributed to the loss of culture, strained family relations, feelings of distrust towards the government and police, and brought about socioeconomic inequalities between indigenous and non-indigenous communities, as well as between reserve and off-reserve communities. Until recently, few Canadians were aware the past system existed. Those who did were likely unaware of the fact that it was never a law. It was never a law. Mandates are not laws. What did we just go through for the last 2 fucking years, man? Mandates are not laws. Jeez. If more people knew about this, if more people actually studied history and put the chip off their shoulder aside and actually work together having a real conversation, if more people knew the actual art of having debate and actually knew how to have a conversation, because I'm sorry, but most people cannot have conversations. Most people want to talk and talk and talk. They don't want to hear what you're saying, and they don't want to be interested in anything anybody else has to say. They are one way, solipsistic, narcissistic, bullheaded, bubble-headed, fucking goofy. That's what they are. They're dross that focus on themselves only. And that's a very mean thing to say. And guess what? If you sit there and you think to yourself, that's not me, it's probably you. It's probably you. And if you're offended, it is most definitely you. Now, I'm not going to say that all of my listeners are definitely like that, because thankfully, the majority of people in my circle personally are not like that. But I have spent the time carefully to actually find people that genuinely want to have a conversation. The law of attraction. These people have most certainly come into my life. We've had, you know, Rod come on the show a few times. We've had Pixie come on the show a few times. A lot of my previous guests have come on my show, and they like to have conversation. That's the whole point of my show when I have a guest, is I want to hear them. I want to hear them speak. I want to hear them tell their story. But we can go ahead and we can have conversation. I want to hear what they have to say. And it drives me nuts when I'm listening to an interview. And I understand they've only got a certain amount of time and things that they have to ask these questions and blah, blah, blah. But I like to hear the whole conversation. And I love it when my guests actually get to speak. That's why I want a 3-minute or a 3-hour show now instead of an hour and a half like I used to. Is when I have people on, I actually want to hear them speak. I want them to be able to have the time that they need to gab away, you know? But then I also want to be able to have a conversation with those people. I want to be able to sit down and actually talk and be able to go back and forth and not be interrupted over and over and over again. But if more people would have known about shit like this, and more people would have actually got the chip off their shoulder, I bet you. This whole COVID shit they tried to pull on us would have been entirely different. So that's why I'm reading these things to you today. As heated as I am, I'm reading these things to you today because you guys need to sit down and you need to understand what they did to you, they already did to the indigenous people here. They just did it to them again. The elders that we have in our society, they did it to them again. Okay? Moving forward. Efforts have been made to highlight oral histories about the past system and bring the truth to light. In 2015, after an extensive 5-year investigation, filmmaker Alex Williams released the documentary The Past System, which explores the origins and implication of the system as well as what it was like to live under it. Narrated by actor Tantu Cardinal, the film was nominated for 2 Canadian Screen Awards. And there you guys go, the COVID vaccine pass for the Indigenous reserves once upon a time. There's your passport, but it's not actually mandated by nothing. We just decided that we didn't want you to do it, and it was within your best interest because we deemed it was for the best of the people. So coming back to population control once again, since we're talking about the COVID stuff, we've just talked about gene therapy. We've talked about the COVID pass system and how they've already used this as they were using the indigenous people as a testing ground. Again, history repeated itself and most are unaware. Then going back to what I was thinking in the garden, because like I was saying, like Geert Van den Bosch and these scientists were talking about how these gene therapies were going to start taking people out. They were going to start killing people in mass. And then they used taking away people's fundamental freedoms through the use of mandates and threatening to fine you if you didn't do what we wanted you to do, even though it wasn't actually any law. The thought of having your job taken away from you by a minute amount of individuals was more than enough to put people into place, I guess. Coupled by the fear that you're going to die if you don't, because everybody's going to die from a cold. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. In the beginning, they did have me. Because in the beginning, while everybody was watching their TV and playing their football games and shit like that, I was watching what was going down in China. And I know that the Chinese government loves to lie about a lot of things. They also like to make people disappear when they share a lot of things. Still waiting for Chen Qixi. He came out for a while. They had him. And then he came back. And then he disappeared again. So he was back for a couple months. Getting a drink of water here. I am thirsty. I know it's squishy. Give me 1 second here, guys. I am parched. I talk too much and this air is dry. You never got a water jug today. Oh, no. This one needs water.
She's just drinking.
Well, she's going for your water jug there, so give her some more. You got to fill it up twice. Fill it up again. Don't argue, just fill it up again. We got a dog last week. She's 10 years old and drinks water like a fish. But it's hot today. So, back to my theory for like the 100th time. So I was sitting there listening to my garden, and I was listening to this book, and I was thinking about the COVID stuff and the vaccine passes and the indigenous passes and things like that. And I can't help but wonder myself, because I remember specifically telling a friend of mine, because I remember we were on the phone, we were looking at the stuff happening in China. And I remember specifically telling her, I remember, you know, and that's Scarlett, and she's on her own radio network now, Freedom Revolution Network. She has Clarity After Dark. And telling her how much you want to bet, how much you want to bet they're going to inject these people with these freaking vaccines, and it's going to start dropping people like flies with heart attacks and cancer. Because that's what people are used to. People are used to people having heart attacks and cancer. Because of the way that we have manufactured our food and because of the way that we grow our food, this is causing serious detrimental effects to our body. Seriously detrimental. And I had a theory that it's just like, you know, obviously they want to depop people through the sterilization of humans by the vaccines, by sterilizing our young LGBTQ youth. By it's honest to God, you guys, it is so messed up. But a grown-ass woman of like 30 years old cannot go into a clinic and ask to have a hysterectomy and continue to identify as a cis woman that doesn't want to have kids, but her periods are so painful that she can't get out of bed. And this happens month after month after month, and she doesn't want to deal with it anymore. And the doctors will not let her have a hysterectomy, because what if you want to have kids in the future? Or you need your husband's permission? What if you change your mind? But you can go in as a 20-year-old woman, or hell, they've even done this to like 16-year-olds, a child. They're going after children, although rarer, obviously. But it's still happening. And you can't deny that it's not, because more and more facts are starting to come out on the daily. You can go find these things on YouTube. There was that whole hospital that was shut down because they had that rogue doctor that was giving surgeries and stuff to kids after they said that they weren't. It came out. It was a HIPAA violation by somebody releasing the documents of these children. Absolutely, they broke the law doing it. But they broke the law, and it came out that they had a rogue doctor still giving children surgeries, like as young as 12 years old. So a 20-year-old woman can go into a clinic and get sterilizing hormones like testosterone. If you're on testosterone for long enough, especially if you're going from male to female, if you're on estrogen for long enough, it'll sterilize you. And vice versa, as a female to male, it'll sterilize you. And then you can go in and you can get a fake dick put in. You can get a hysterectomy. You can get all these things removed, your breast cut off, et cetera, et cetera. You can be completely sterilized if you want to pretend to be a man. For whatever reason, I don't care if you want to identify as a male or a man or whatever, I don't, even as a turtle or shit. I don't care. You do you. Whatever makes you happy, if it doesn't hurt me, I don't care. I don't care. Just do whatever makes you happy, you know? It's like, I, at the end of the day, what you're, if you cut your leg off to do what you want to do, then I don't, you, this is not going to affect me. It's not going to affect me. It does affect me, though, when you want to be able to put on disability money because you got your leg cut off because you want to do. That's where I don't think things are right, and this is where I think the socialist system needs to fucking end. Because if you want to have mental health issues and I'm forced to pay for you because you can't seek the appropriate help for yourself, I don't think that's right. You know, that's kind of weird, but okay. But that's another discussion for another time. Sterilizing people through those means. And then people are just sterilizing themselves because, like, they don't want to, they can't produce kids in this economy. It is so freaking hard to try and raise a healthy kid in this economy. It's absolutely insane that most people won't do it. In fact, in Canada, if you're a single mom with, like, six kids, you get more money than you do if you're married. I had a friend who dealt with that. She has, like, six or seven kids. And there was some shit going down, her and her husband with their newborn, who was literally just born like a couple days before I was her doula. They had gotten permission from her ex to move to a different province because he had just got a new job, and then decided to change his mind, and because it hadn't gone through the court, she did not have any legal standing to actually move, so she had to stay in Saskatchewan with her kids while he had to go to work at the new job. And she had sat down and actually calculated the amount of money that she would have been getting as a single mom versus what they were getting as married. And, like, I don't know if they ever actually did. I don't think they did. But if she would have separated from him or they would have divorced or whatever, she would have got twice the amount of money, no joke, from the government to raise her kids as a single mom than if she would have, like, been with her husband. Isn't that interesting? It's almost as if the government is trying to make it so that you want to be on your own. But yet they screech about individualism. Individualism is bad, but we'll pay you if you're on your own. Unless, you're, of course, you're a white male in your 20s to your 50s, in which case we're going to tax you the hardest out of everybody else. Interesting. White single male. They don't get any money. They got to work their ass off for it. And they get over half of it in taxes taken away on them. But, you know, that privilege, though. Of course. So, they're working on depopulating everybody. And then saying that they want to bring in immigrants. And I couldn't help but think to myself when I was reading this book, and I'll go over the chapter that I was reading the other day, but it's talking about specifically damaged genetics. And when you have damaged genetics, those things can compound into the next child that you have. So our grandparents, they had fairly good genetics because they had fairly good nutrition. Their food actually nurtured their bodies. That's back when they had rotating crop rotation. There wasn't as many people on the planet to feed. They had whole ingredients. They had things like butter and lard. They didn't really have canola oil. And if they had things like, you know, rapeseed oil, it was cold pressed and things like that. The old school way, things that took time. They had things like sourdough and all this other stuff. Yeah, they did have like white bleached flour and things like that. But like the majority of things, it was still old school. Then we have the Gen Xers. And they had the privilege of getting, for the most part, the good genes from the boomers. And they had, for the most part, more wholesome foods than the millennials did. The Gen Xers is when they started to really start making lab food, if that makes sense. Then we have the millennials and the commercial monocropping has continued. The increasing industrialization when it comes to meat continuing. It's no longer smaller hobby farms with hand milking. It's all machines now. We've got food sciences. You can look up things like food science. A good book is Pandora's Lunchbox. Obviously, this Deep Nutrition by Shanahan. It's a really good one. But if you just hit Google or go to libgen.is, libgen.is, and start looking up like food science or like go to your local library. Your local librarians might have some very good suggestions on food science and stuff for you. How much you want to bet there's a good portion of them? Not all librarians. If you find like more of the small town conservative librarians, bet you they'll be able to hook you up with a couple books. The city slickers are a bunch of lefty goofies. Probably not going to find a whole lot there. Although, when it comes to things like food, a lot more people are awake on food than they are politics and vaccines and other forms of health. But a lot of people are interested in eating healthy food, or at the least, if they know about food science, it's because they're interested in the technology of food science, and hell, they might even think that it's good for them, in which case they will also have suggestions for books for you. But again, read those with a grain of salt, because a lot of this new technology we haven't really tested on human beings and the lack of nutrients and what those problems are going to cause. But yet now we seem to have kids growing like, you know, where they're missing legs and they're blind and they've got neurological issues and all this other shit on top of the heart attacks that they're all getting. But then we've got Gen Zers and Gen Alphas. And statistically speaking, our younger population are more sick than we've ever had for kids in the history of humankind. And I know a lot of these sick kids would not be alive today if we didn't have, particularly the medicinal system. So on one hand, I do quite often crap all over our medicinal system. Just because of things like the Flexner Report and Carnegie and the way he took over the medicinal industry and bumped up the pharmaceutical complex with the petroleum products and things like that. I'm not going to go so far as to say that it hasn't saved people or be so ignorant to say that, oh, science is a sham or anything like that, because that's just silly too. Like, let's just not to resort to extremism, because I don't see the point in resorting to extremism anymore in a lot of things, because a lot of people can say, oh, fuck, be denied that when it comes to things like major trauma, surgery, severe infections, not so much cancers, but severe infections, that these people are qualified and they know, for the most part, how to save your life. I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I'm pretty sure coconut oil cannot reattach a leg that just got ripped off in a car accident. So when it comes to doctors, I'm definitely going to hand them over the keys on that one. That one, I will, for the most part, I'm still going to be wary. I'm still going to be like, you know, I have lots of questions here. But for the most part, I'm going to trust they know more than I do. So I'm going to hope that they do their job. And if they don't do the job, then I'm going to be really mad. Outside of that, they can definitely, like, you know, with things like cancer, long-term disease and stuff, this is where I really think that we need to start, like, we need to start subverting these doctors. Genuinely, we need to start subverting these physicians and start getting them to understand that you need to grow a pair of balls when it comes to these alternative medicines, and you need to stand up for them. Because when they hit the wall and they don't know what else to do, they come to us and be like, what can we do? Well, we can show you some things that may not work, depending on what you require, depending on what's going on with you, depending on what's going on with, you know, your spiritual state, your emotional state, your mental state. It may or may not work, but what's the harm of trying? What's the harm of trying? Let's try it. Why not? And if it works, I mean, you can call that placebo factor, whatever you want. It doesn't really matter. It's like, in the end, it's still energy medicine. And more science is starting to look to the fact that energy medicine exists. It simply does. Because they love to buy up all the patents for any time anybody's trying to do anything because it's energy. I mean, lasers are energy. You know, we're building things with that and destroying things with that. You know, it's really interesting shit. If you just, like, start looking into these things, like, there's so many things that if we quit with the patent bullshit and we quit the greed and things like that, I mean, we might end up killing ourselves. Maybe that's why the government is putting a cap on creativity so much. And I'm not going to give them and say that, oh, well, you know, they're trying to save us. Most definitely not. Because obviously they're trying to enslave us with it. But it makes you wonder that if we quit putting a cap on creativity as much as we do, how far we could go if humans were allowed to actually create for the greater good. But not like this Canadian encyclopedia, well, it's for the greater good because we think so. Like, what's actually good for humanity? You know what I mean? If, like, instead of teaching LGBTQ education to kids and sex education to kids, because I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing that children be taught sexual education so long as it is age appropriate, which a lot of these things are not. They are most definitely not. But having random strangers force it upon kids, and that's inappropriate for their age. I mean, what, little kids don't really fucking care. They want to play with ponies and cars. What are you doing teaching little kids about drag queens when they're 5 years old? Like, leave that to the 15-year-old. You know what I mean? Because we can say, like, oh, they're just kids. They're 14 and 15. Yeah, well, guess what? 14 and 15-year-olds do a lot of things in the back room that you don't really know about, and they hide that shit from you. Having been a 14, 15-year-old once, I wasn't really into that. But let me tell you, all my friends are fucking each other. You know, by the time you get to 16, I don't think my class is just a bunch of hoes. I'm not even kidding. My school was a bunch of hoes. So I think age-appropriate education is most certainly important. But I feel like they're missing a spiritual aspect to a lot of that. It's just like, maybe you shouldn't just be fucking everything with legs, because maybe there is a spiritual aspect to that. I mean, women absorb the DNA of men when they sleep with them. You're going to tell me that's not going to have some sort of impact on you later on down the line? Maybe that means that maybe we shouldn't just be sleeping with anybody, whoever we want. You know what I mean? But that's another conversation for another time that I think we should have on this show at some point. But back to the nutrition, in terms of compounding nutrition, or so lack of it, each generation of people that we keep having keep getting sicker and sicker. And the one chapter in this book talks about, you can see it in facial deformities. The firstborn child usually has, for the most part, a fully formed jaw. Good bone denture, good structure. They look like they should be human. And then when you have these people that pump out like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kids year after year after year without having proper, I mean, as it is, it already takes a toll on your body when you keep having kids. So they recommend, especially in traditional cultures, that you have them about every 3 years or so. That's not to say that you shouldn't, you can't have kids, but if you want to have proper, healthy, nutritionally dense little bodies, because it takes almost a year to be pregnant, then you have a baby, then you're supposed to breastfeed for, you know, up to 2 years. So that's 3 years. So that's 3 years that you're giving nutrition from your body as a woman to a growing little human. And then on top of that, trying to keep your healthy. So, like, you've got to double your intake, and your body can only absorb so much, which is why you need high-nutrient food, which is what current foods don't really have, which is unfortunate. And it's compounding into our younger generation. So more and more kids are being born with deformities, deficiencies, issues, mental issues, physical issues, like I said, like missing limbs or just stunted growth or neurological issues or all these other kinds of things. And we're not even talking about having like pesticides and herbicides and the shit they're spraying in the air and all these things that are being put into a woman's body while she's growing a baby and then breastfeeding. We're just talking about the lack of. David Steffen, I've had him on my show a couple times, a decent friend of mine. His dad came up with True Hope. Back in the day, David's mom was bipolar. And she was kind of off a rocker a bit, as bipolar people usually are. Not by their choice, but they have deficiencies. And David's mom went and sought help. David's mom got medication. And within a week, David's mom committed suicide. Because that's the one thing a lot of people don't tell you about, is a lot of these medications that are supposed to be for your mental health. Look into the package insert. And a lot of them contain a black box warning. And that black box warning tells you that there's increased risk of suicide. Kind of weird that you're taking a medication to stop you from killing yourself, but yet when you take this medication, it's going to drive you crazy. And there's a higher chance that you're going to kill yourself. Weird, huh? I think it's on purpose. But that's besides the point. That's just my opinion. So David's mom killed herself. David's brother was a Columbine waiting to happen. David's dad took David's brother to every psychological expert in Alberta begging for help. And every single one of them told him that there's nothing they could do. You might as well just prepare for the funeral when he snaps, finally, and kills everybody. David's dad had a work partner. They did real estate or whatever together. And David's dad told his work partner about what was going on with his family. His daughter was loopy. His son was going crazy. His wife was dead. He was running into some problems. Or David's dad's partner, his work partner, told David's dad that he had pigs, experience with pigs. And when the pigs were not given proper nutrition, the pigs would start eating the tails and ears off of other pigs. When they gave them proper nutrition, the pigs stopped eating each other. So David's dad had the idea. Let's start looking into nutrition. And he settled on a couple things. I know grape seed oil was one of them. I don't remember the other ones specifically. You'll have to, in David's seminar, you'll have to go listen to him speak. He's a great speaker. So David's dad started his son, not David, his brother, like David's brother, on grapeseed oil and a couple other things. It was like three things, I think, three or four things. And shortly after, David's dad was no longer getting phone calls from the school telling him that he had another bad day. David's dad started getting phone calls from the school asking what he had done to help his son, because they had other kids who were having issues, and they were wondering if he could help them too. And so it began. They started helping other people. And then the next victim of his experiment, which turned out good, by the way, was his daughter, because she was grade A crazy, to put it nicely. She could not be left alone. She had to be under constant supervision because she quite often tried killing herself. She tried killing her husband. She tried killing her kid. She was nuts. She was fucking nuts. Time came when her husband had to go on a work trip, and so he left her with her dad, David's dad. You know, this was David's sister, because she couldn't be left alone. So halfway through the trip, David's dad said, fuck this. I'm not going to be doing this. This is absolutely insane. I'm going to use these tactics on her too. I'm going to use this nutrition on her too. Her husband was not happy about this, and he came home, was very angry that he was doing this. However, by the time he got home, she was already doing somewhat better. She wasn't a complete, total grade A psycho. And it took a little while, but after a couple years, from having severe mental health issues to being perfectly happy, healthy, normal, and actually able to have a healthy, normal life. Both David's brother and sister are healthy and happy people, having been in severe mental distress. David's brother being bipolar and crazy, his sister the same, and his dad helped them, and so they funded True Hope. And they had gotten funding approval to have a double-blind placebo study done on people with bipolar in Canada with their True Hope product. The next day, they got a call from Health Canada asking them, who approved you for this? And it's been nothing but a bullshit battle ever since. In fact, David has recently had to censor all of the studies, like 30 studies or 35 studies or whatever the hell it was, on studies for bipolar, schizophrenia, other mental health issues, physical health issues, on their website, thanks to this censorship bill that went through in Canada. And because these studies were not approved in Canada, Canada Health has now called David Steffen of True Hope. You can find them, True Hope, TrueHope.com, that they can't have these studies on their website anymore because they weren't approved in Canada. That's how bad the censorship is getting. But as you can see by that story, and you can just go outside and look, more and more people are starting to fucking go crazy. And our younger generation are a bunch of narcissistic little solipsistic shit with a lot of mental health issues, a lot of physical health issues. It's getting really bad, and it shouldn't be this way. But I can't help but wonder to myself if the reason why they're starting to depopulate everybody, both the young and the old, because you're not going to tell me that they're not trying to depopulate the younger. There's a reason why they were injecting pregnant women. They're trying to kill the baby. There's a reason why they were doing it. Sterilize and kill these children. On top of making it a giant experiment, obviously, because I guess it just came out not too long ago that they admitted that this was a giant experiment, that a lot of people got a really high dose of it, and a lot of people got a whole ass placebo. Like we knew, every conspiracy theorist is sitting here, chest in the air, we were right. I kind of wish we weren't, though. I kind of wish that this never happened. Because it is really hard watching friends and family now suffer with health issues, especially heart problems, neurological problems, watching your friend's husband go blind from a single shot, watching people get heart attacks over and over again from their shots, watching people get their cancer come back after remission from these fucking shots. I'm all over the place with emotions today. But I can't help but wonder if the reason why they're taking out a bunch of people and depopulating is because they see the writing on the wall. Obviously, there's going to be some slavery aspects to it. Duh. They're not a savior here. But I can't help but wonder if they can see the writing on the wall, that they're tracking everybody, you know? And I can't help but wonder if they have people's information, that they know which one to give you, or they know which areas that they're going to give certain people certain shots. That, like, they want to kill off a bunch of people because they know that with the current health state of humanity, if we keep populating and breeding the way they are, we're going to have nobody look after these kids. Like, you talk to any autism parent where they've got one, two, three kids that can't live normal, healthy lives. They've got mental disabilities, physical disabilities, and while these parents fight every day for their kids, and they fight and they love their kids so damn hard. It's just the amount of love these people have for their kids, despite the challenges. They're there for their kids through and through. It's one thing to raise a kid and then send them on their own when they get to be 18, 19, 20, or fuck, depending on where you are, 16. I'm not saying 16 is right, but a lot of 16-year-olds go out into the world, usually more so like 18, 19, though. But you know, these young adults go out in the world, but these parents that have these kids with these disabilities, they never get to go out in the world. They end up raising these kids. And if they put them anywhere, it's into a home. And they let the government take care of them. But when these parents die, if these parents are the ones raising these kids, when these parents die, who's going to look after their kid? Because it's not going to be the family. The family doesn't even want to look after their own elderly population. They put the old people into an old folks home, you know? And I understand, like, you know, old folks' homes, they have older elderly people there. You know, they like to chat. They like to have their coffees and be with other people that they find is community. We don't even look after our elderly people, never mind our disabled people. And when those disabled people get old, who's going to look after them? If, like, half of the people their age are also disabled. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's why I can't help but wonder if this death cult is starting to off people and depopulate. It's not because there's too many people on the planet. That is an utter bullshit fucking lie. The consumerism that we've engaged in is what's doing things like killing the planet. It's a matter of how many of these people are actually going to be able to live healthy, stable lives and be able to give back to the planet. You know what I mean? It's like if we're constantly, if because the way we're continuing the monocrop and like the government, the New World Order is trying to cut down on nitrogen on farmers now. That was just announced like last year, that they're going to be cutting down on fertilizers because nitrogen is causing problems, blah, blah, blah. And all the farmers around here are freaking out. If they cut down on nitrogen, we're not going to have crops. So obviously that would lead to immediate mass starvation, which would not be a good thing. It's bad enough that things like theft are starting to get. Somebody, I fucking know, guys, somebody stole $1 million sprayer from a neighbor from here. Okay? Just over like 15 minutes towards town. Somebody had the cojones to go into a farmer's field and steal $1 million sprayer. Now, you can't just drive a sprayer off the lot. You know how, you have to know how to work a big tractor like that. So somebody who is knowledgeable about tractors got in and drove that thing off the farm. While, you know, they might have just left it in the field because they were going to the house or left it over overnight because they were going to come back and work tomorrow. I also just saw that somebody else around here had their whole boat stolen. Somebody went in, boat on a trailer, and stole their boat. The theft is starting to get pretty significant. It's starting to get really bad. And these are people stealing shit for, like, anywhere from drugs to putting food in their children's mouth. People are starting to get desperate. If you cut off their food, chaos will ensue. Absolute chaos will ensue. It will be very, very bad. However, I wonder if the reason why they're cutting off things like nitrogen is because of how much stripping of the land we have done with synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides, and how much we're poisoning the land. I can't help but wonder to myself, again, obviously these people have an ulterior motive, because if ulterior motive, they would be encouraging these farmers to engage more in things like sustainable farming practices, particularly permaculture farming practices, cover crop farming practices. They wouldn't be screwing with the market for the wheat that they do. They wouldn't be encouraging GMOs, particularly canola, like they do. Because can we just address the fact that, like, all these people are talking about GMOs when it comes to, like, your cauliflower and things? That's bullshit. If you hear anybody talking about, oh, go buy heirloom seeds and organic seeds and things like that, it's bullshit. Okay, just stop. Just stop. I know we're having some issues depending on what brand you're buying this year. Some people were having issues with the wrong seeds being packaged, or I know I've seen a couple people where this year's seeds were not growing, whereas last year's seeds, they were growing. But you can ruin seeds by doing things like spraying them with chemicals or heat treating them or not preserving them right. Like, there's a lot of ways you can ruin the viability of seeds. Or maybe they just sold old seeds, because after a few years, they're not as viable anymore. Maybe that's what happened, is they're selling old seeds, whereas you're using something that you saved from last year, the viability is going to be a lot higher. In fact, hit Google at some point and see the viability of your seeds. Usually the average is about 4 to 7 years. About 4 to 7 years, depending on the seeds. I think, like, after 2 years, you start losing, like, 25% vitality. And like I said, it just depends on the kind of seeds. And if you keep them cold, not frozen, but if you keep them frozen, make sure that they're extremely dehydrated. Because if they're not completely dehydrated, they will freeze and burst. Okay? Keep them cold. Keep them in a cold, dark place. And then you will, like, the colder, the better. Again, if you're going to freeze them, make sure that they're completely dehydrated so you don't ruin them. But it will make them a lot viable, more viable for a lot longer. The people at the top are not going to waste putting GMO food in to feed to you if they're not going to get any sort of return. Them controlling the farmers, the big corporate farmers, the things like canola and stuff, yeah, they're going to get a corporate return and they're going to be able to track and trace and they're going to be able to do what they want with their crop. You as the average Joe putting a GMO broccoli in your backyard, they're not going to be stupid enough to waste their money on you. They're not stupid enough to waste their money on things like elderberry syrup in labs because they get no money back from it. They get no money back from it. That's another thing that this book talks about. This Deep Nutritionist talks about is it talks about that, you know, once upon a time, you could get funding from the government and stuff in order to conduct these studies that you see fit. Now it's all private investors. And only the private investors with money are going to give you money. And only the, you know, like Bill Gates? Yeah. And then they're going to skew the results on what they want to be tested. They're going to skew the results. That's what science is now, is billionaires funding scientists to do the kind of studies that they want. And a lot of these studies, they're not studying herbs unless they can extract specific examples or specific things out of these herbs to turn into pharmaceuticals. They're all working with, like, biogenetics and things like that. They're working on eugenic shit. They're not even piddling around with plants and things like that or actual anything that's going to matter unless, of course, they're studying the effects of something. So, in other words, they can create some sort of lab-fed crap that they can control to feed back to you. If it gives you the opportunity to be sovereign and share with your community, they're not even going to give that to you unless they know for sure they have the means to control that in the first place. Giving everybody a gene therapy that's going to pop your fucking heart, yeah, they're going to get some investment on that. Making a GMO broccoli, nah, they're not going to get investment on that. They're not even going to waste the time, energy, or money. They'll be more likely to outlaw you growing your own fucking broccoli in your own backyard with bylaws about messy yards than they will about giving you seeds for a broccoli to grow. So just, if you hear anybody talking about, like, organic seeds or, oh, non-GMO, not even so much the organic seeds because, like, you know, organic, obviously, like, you know, if you don't want your shit sprayed with chemicals and things, you know, that will carry down the genetics of the plant at some point. But, like, GMO seeds, if anybody's telling you about GMO seeds, don't buy GMO seeds. They don't know what the fuck they're talking about. They're just running the mouth. And I hate to say that because I know some of this is going to offend some of my listeners, but you're on crack. You're on crack. Get off the crack. That's not how it works. But yeah, theory is that they're taking people out because they know the kind of people that we're bringing up in this world. They cannot be controlled and they cannot be productive because you cannot have somebody at home on disability requiring government assistance be a productive member of society. You can't do it. They can only have a limited amount of people be able to do those kinds of things. And they're whittling down on those numbers, which is why in Canada, they're more willing to give you euthanasia now instead of to pay, have somebody look after you. Because in their eyes, you're just a waste of time and money. And that's not me saying that because I don't believe that. I think that's really messed up, which is why whenever I have, you know, comparing apples to oranges, obviously, but in terms of farm life, they see you as animals. You are animals to them. You are meant to be controlled and consumed. That is what you are to them. And having lived on a farm now for a few years and been involved in, you know, dairy barns and chicken barns and where right now, like I said, we were baling today. Rain kind of put a dent in that. Hopefully it's nice tomorrow that we can go bale tomorrow. But having a farm with animals, I don't like just putting down animals if I can do something about it. Unless they have absolutely no quality of life, in which case it's more humane to put them down, but I will fight tooth and nail from any possible angle to try to make sure that they have some kind of quality of life because it's a life. Once it's gone, it's gone. And that's my family. My animals are my family. They're not just pets. Like, people look to me and they say, oh, they're just pets. They're supposed to be farm. No, like, that's my family, yo. That's my, like, you know, that those are my homies, my dogs, my cats, my goats, my chickens, those are my homies, you know? And it's just like, chickens we raise to kill is just like, you know, it makes me cry every time we come to butchering time, I cry. I just, kind of why I'm hoping to get a wallapini going, because I would prefer more vegetables than to have to consume animals. And I know that sounds kind of crazy considering, like, vegetables have a consciousness and can feel and speak to each other too. It's like, I mean, if I could have my way, I would just go straight breatharian and never consume anything again. If I could have my way. Is it possible? Probably. What it would take to get there, I don't know. I have no idea. And I don't know if I'm disciplined enough to even get there or what that would even take to get there. I don't know. But it's always something that I'm looking into here or there. It's something I'm interested in. Whether or not I can do it in this frame of reality, that's a good question. But myself personally, if I could go on and just not consume again, or just like be more of a frugivore and take the fruits that vegetables put out, not necessarily eat the plant, but the fruits that these beings put out, which are meant to be eaten, I would rather that. Rather than hurting the actual plant itself, because I don't really care for that, you know what I mean? Not really my thing, but it is what it is, and that's just reality at this current time in my current place, and I just come to accept that, and if I can change it, then I will most certainly work towards changing it. But as of right now, it is what it is. But going back to people being seen as animals, if you pay attention to any sort of corporate farming, big farming operations, any old school farmers where they have a lot of animals or anything like that, as soon as you have like a sick animal or an injured animal or something like that, they'll tell you just to put it down because it's not worth the time or investment to try and get that animal back to any sort of quality of life. It's easier to just kill them. And this is the kind of mental state, the political state that the government of Canada in particular is starting to adopt. And it's really disgusting because more and more of the world is starting to move this way. That we're going back to just putting people down. But in the age of social media, however, people are realizing, you know, I don't want to be put down. Like, I have a life. I matter. You know, and it's one thing if somebody chooses it because they have a terminal illness. They know they're dying anyway. There's a lot of people that are like, you know, have terminal cancer. I had a friend that chose assisted death because he had terminal cancer and he had like two or three heart attacks in a year from the fucking vaccine. His kidneys were shot. His heart was failing. He had cancer. He didn't want to be here anymore. He didn't want to, he went from having like a 2-acre garden to not being able, he got to go outside twice in one summer. And he said, fuck this. This is no quality of life that I want to continue to have. Why would I want to continue to fight to have any sort of quality of life living in a diaper and a chair when I'm old, I've lived my time on this planet, and I just kind of don't want to be here anymore. And, you know, I respected his choice. I was upset to see him go. But at the end of the day, it was his choice. And, you know, his health was failing. His health was failing. And that's what he chose. But for people who want to fight, who want to still be here, I mean, if he wanted to still be here and stuff like that, then, like, you know, we should have fought for him, you know? And a lot of people are trying to fight for themselves and advocate for themselves because they want to be here. They don't want to die yet for whatever reason. They want to be here because friends and family, or they want to be here because they have their life purpose, which isn't complete yet, or, you know, anything like that. It's just like, we shouldn't just be putting these people in the trash bin just because they're not desirable anymore. You know what I mean? And I don't think we should treat animals this way. I don't think we should treat plants this way. I think if we actually had more respect for other beings of all kinds, you know, we wouldn't be so quick to just throw each other away and just give up on one another. Because, like, if we had more respect for ourselves and we just didn't give up on ourselves, you know, it's just, it makes me so sad, the state of affairs today, that our spirituality has been stripped from us in so many ways. That's where when you look at, like, you know, the traditional indigenous ways, or like the old ways of like any sort of group, really, and the connection that they had with the land. You know, we think it's a lot of woo-woo bullshit, and then it's just, oh, well, you know, the land is to be used for our purpose, and it doesn't mean nothing, anything or anything like that. But when you actually take a step away from the consumerism God mindset, the wannabe God mindset, and you actually, like, spend some time and be with nature and be with people and be with animals. You know, you just be with. It's a lot harder to kill and destroy when you actually spend time and create relationship with these other beings, which is why it's become so easy for the state to just eliminate people, is because we've spent so much time dehumanizing one another. You know what I mean? It's upsetting. It's upsetting. And, like, you know, it's one thing, like, I find myself constantly in a conundrum where, like, one minute I'm like, fuck them people. But then the next minute it's just like, nah, don't fuck them people. Like, they're people too. And it's hard because, you know, when people don't want to take accountability and they don't want to heal themselves, it's so fucking hard not to dehumanize them and just, like, you know, throw them away and not give them a chance. Like, everybody deserves a chance. But at the same time, it's like, how much am I willing to sacrifice myself to give them a chance? You know what I mean? And this is where we come in that circular logic, and exactly why we've come to where we come, where I just can't help but wonder if the reason why they're killing a bunch of people off now is because they're sick. And these people know that they could give these people the proper nutrition and energy healing medicine, but they don't want to. They would rather just kill them off, because it takes a lot of resources, a lot of targeted healthy resources to get these people back to where they need to be. And unfortunately, we have created an entire economic system based off of depleted resources. And in order to turn that around, it's not to say that we can't turn that around. We can most certainly turn that around. We can go back to cover crops and letting the land rest and getting back to more herbal natural medicine and letting the forest grow and changing the financial system and blah, blah, blah. We absolutely can. And people that say that we can't, they're just blind to themselves. We can do anything we want to do. The all is the mind. Hermetic principle number one, you know? And principle number two, correspondence. Everything is connected. As soon as you realize that, like, you know, there's the other four of five, thinking, because there's seven in total. As soon as you realize that all these things can be connected, you know, and that we have the power to change these things, it's like, I think we could really turn things around. But it's a matter of education. It's a matter of getting people off their fucking Jersey Shore. Like, don't get me wrong, I like a little episode of Jersey Shore here or there. I like makeup here or there. I like to do fun things here or there, but it doesn't take precedence over connection and relationship. You know what I mean? It's like, it's fun. It's fun to storytell and dress up and cosplay and things like that. But if those things cease to exist, I wouldn't cry. I mean, it would suck, but I wouldn't cry, because personally rather be living in the forest with a few people being happy, you know, and living in a whole ass city with a bunch of miserable people that are sick. So, that's my thoughts on that entire thing. We'll have to see how these things are going forward. But, hold on here. Let's see, how big is this chapter here? Holy smokes, this is a big-ass chapter. We're going to get through some of this chapter here today. But we're not going to be able to get through all of it. So your guys are going to have to download this book. It's called Deep Nutrition. Hold on, I'm just scrolling up here. Blue list. And I lost my page here now. I'm just scrolling and scrolling. Oops. Okay, I went past the whole freaking chapter I was going to read to you guys here. One more second. Here we go. This one in particular, I think a lot of people need to read. Because chapter 7, Good Fats and Bad, How the Cholesterol Theory Created a Sickness Epidemic. And out of all the foods we eat, oh, I never did make a radio show about that yet. But there's like a dirty five. You'll always find high fructose corn syrup, wheat, dairy, soy, and vegetable oil. Those five things in the standard American diet. Look in the back of your ingredients list for any manufactured food that you ever buy, and you will find those five in particular in every single pre-made food ever. And when you find out how you manufacture these five, particularly like soy and vegetable oil, you're going to crap your pants because they have completely destroyed our food and eliminated them all nutrients. Okay, so we're going to read this chapter to you. It might take a little while, but here we go. When I was fresh out of medical school, if you had asked me what causes heart disease, I would have answered fat and cholesterol, of course. I felt confident in this advice, not only because it was what I had been taught, seemed to make intuitive sense. I could picture fat accumulating inside a person's artery, gradually choking it closed like cooking grease in a pipe. Moreover, the American Medical Association, the American Heart Association, and the American Diabetes Association, the American Cancer Society, the American College of Cardiologists, and other organizations endorse this cholesterol theory of heart disease. But as I started practicing medicine, one thing about the theory nagged me. Why, if cholesterol is so deadly, were so many of my oldest patients enjoying excellent health after a lifetime of consuming butter, eggs, and red meat? Not long ago, physicians and scientists at the Center of Establishment Medicine started asking similar questions in light of increasing evidence that the cholesterol issue warranted revisiting. In 2001, a few nutrition scientists in the Harvard School of Public Health went so far as to suggest that the low-fat campaign has been based on little scientific evidence and may have caused unintended health consequences. Further, they contended that the low-fat anti-cholesterol campaign might not only be a flop as far as fighting obesity and diabetes were concerned, and might be making both epidemics worse. Thanks to Michael Pollan, the author of several recent books who cite this article and others like it, the reading public has witnessed cracks forming in the foundation of modern nutritional thought. As more researchers discover all manner of evidence that animal fat has health-promoting effects, such data has now been published by dozens of academic journals, the pressure is building towards a sea of change in organized medicine. Until that change comes, however, your doctor is unlikely to contradict the official guidelines. Only when current guidelines change to reflect better science will the average doctor's advice on nutrition cease to put patients at risk for those unintended health consequences. By the end of this chapter, you may be convinced that there is little reason to fear cholesterol. My hope is that, at the very least, you will recognize that the cholesterol theory of heart disease is far from unassailable, and that when your doctor admonishes you to get your numbers down, you need not accept this advice without objection. The other thing I want you to understand is that a necessary outgrowth of the indictrol is a rejection of the traditional natural fats that have sustained humankind for thousands of generations. It's a little like the idea of Nestle successfully used in the 1940s to sell infant formula to my grandmother and many other women, claiming it was more perfect than breast milk. Those who mean to replace natural, traditional foods with modern-day food-like products in the name of health are championing the position that nature doesn't know best, a corporation does. This is an extraordinary claim requiring extraordinary science, a burden they have failed to meet. So why do we fall for it? To understand how easy it is to sell us completely bogus ideas to get us begging for products that we barely know anything about, we will begin with the most successful sales pitch in the history of medicine, delivered by a man regarded by many as the hero of modern nutritional thought. The man who brought us the low-fat campaign. In 1958, a fit, handsome Ansel Keys stands before a laboratory chalkboard on a CBS documentary entitled The Search to Warn Us of the New American Plague. On screen, we see a row of 10 little wooden men standing on Keyes' desk. He flicks 5 of them off with his finger, knocking them over as he speaks. The chief killer of Americans is cardiovascular disease. It strikes us without warning. Of 10 men, we can expect 5 to get it. From the moment forward, America would turn to Keyes for advice on preventing heart disease. The camera reveals Keyes in front of a small but attentive group of men dressed in white coats, staged to make it appear as though he were delivering a speech to a cadre of enraptured physicians. Though he never claims outright to be a heart specialist, he wears a doctor's jacket and talks confidently about heart health, looking every bit the part of reassuring physician as he soberly enunciates just the right words for maximum impact. Delivered with a newspaper's sense of gravitas and the suave confidence of Mad Men's ad exec character Don Draper, Keyes' charisma catapulted him to the front page of Time magazine. But unlike Draper, who sold household products using catchy slogans delivered by attractive spokespeople, he sold himself as the go-to expert on all manner of heart disease using bad science, covert deception, and fear. In reality, the father of the diet heart hypothesis was not a cardiologist or even an MD. Keyes had earned his PhD in the 1930s studying saltwater eels. His nutritional credentialing rested on the fact that during World War II, the military assigned him to design the ready-to-eat meal that could be stored for years and shipped to millions of soldiers. Dr. Keyes named his pocket-sized meal the K-ration, after himself. When the war was over, the Minnesota Public Health Department hired Keyes to study the problem of rising rates of heart attacks, but ego got the better of him. At his first scientific meeting, he presented the idea that in countries where people ate more animal fat, people died of heart disease more often, suggesting a possible causal relationship. But his statistical work was so sloppy, see the figure on the following page, that he was lambasted by his peers. Rather than cleaning up his act, Keyes vowed vengeance. I'll show those guys. More than anything else, it seems, Keyes wanted folks to think he had single-handedly discovered the cause of heart disease. And so did the country's margarine producers, who in Keyes had found the perfect spokesperson. Though Keyes' work failed to convince professional scientists, at least for the first decade or two, the margarine industry knew that he still had a shot at convincing the man on the street. If the public saw butter and other animal fats would clog their arteries, they could be persuaded to buy margarine instead. It wasn't long before American Heart Association, which depends on large donations of cash from the vegetable oil industry, jumped on the bandwagon with Keyes. They took his sloppy statistics and ran with it, eventually convincing most doctors that steak is a heart attack on a plate, and that margarine made from hydrogenated vegetable oils full of trans fat was healthy. Within a decade, grocery store shelves were loaded with ready-to-go foods the Americans were buying. No longer insisting on fresh food from small farmers right in our neighborhoods, we had been convinced that products made in distant factories were safer, healthier, and better. and they were also cheaper. But even Keyes had his doubts about eating them. By 1961, under increasing scientific scrutiny, Keyes began to waver in his support for his own now publicly accepted diet heart hypothesis. Scientists had pointed out Dr. Keyes' misleading use of scientific terms in public behind the rising rates of heart attacks, but in his laboratory and human experiments, he didn't use animal fat. His subjects were fed margarine made from partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, and what was in the margarine? Trans fat, a full 48%. Trans fats are the infamous artery hardening molecules that have been banned from restaurants in New York City and elsewhere due to their now well-known associations with heart disease. These fats do not exist in foods that nature makes. Trans describes a chemical bond between two molecules, not a molecule per se. More on this below. While nature makes healthy versions of trans-containing fats, the trans fat that has been banned is the byproduct of an industrial process called hydrogenation. And so, for Keyes to conclude from studies that use hydrogenated vegetable oil that animal fat causes heart disease is utterly nonsensical. Unfortunately, the public never heard the straight story, because margarine also contains saturated fat made during the same hydrogenation process that generates trans fat. Food industry was handed the opening they needed to put an anti-saturated fat spin on Keyes' findings. Ignoring the presence of trans fat and other distorted fats in margarine, spokesmen simply blamed saturated fat. And on TV, Keyes equated saturated fat with animal fat, completing the deception. The ingenious spin on the facts is akin to poisoning rats with strychnine laced milk and then blaming the deaths on the milk. Strychnine laced milk. The anti-saturated fat, anti-cholesterol ball was rolling along nicely, and there was so much money being made selling healthy, low-cholesterol, low-fat processed food that the rolling ball wasn't going to be easy to stop. All the news reports you've heard on the hazards of saturated fat and cholesterol are supposed to be in large part by studies that evaluated the bihydrogenated vegetable oil, which is full of unnatural molecules that aren't found in butter, steak, or any natural food. With so much junk science saturated in the media, professionals who give nutritional advice need to go beyond the sound bites to discover the truth for themselves. While it's easy to go with the flow and tell patients to cut out animal fat, doing so turns well-meaning healthcare practitioners into unwitting participants in an ongoing campaign to sell high-profit margin man-made substitutes for natural foods, substitutes which, in turn, make people sick. In an earlier chapter, I suggested that our health took a turn for the worse when we stopped talking about food the way farmers and chefs do and adapted the language to scientists. The scientists are not the problem. The problem arises when we use scientific terms without a true understanding of what we're saying. Case in point, the story I just told you about the media scaring us away from saturated fat coming from foods like butter and cream when the food in the studies actually was margarine and was, therefore, loaded with trans fats, and only recently, 50 years down the road, we've learned they are bad for our health. These days, we are so frequently hear terms such as trans and polyunsaturated, it's easy to forget that those are chemical descriptions of compounds with specific types of molecular bonds and conformations. Details most non-chemists wouldn't be able to describe. So when the young man restocking salad dressing on grocery store shelves insists the dressing is healthy because it's high in polyunsaturates, or your server at the local restaurant extols the merits of omega-3s in canola, it's best to take this nutritional advice with a grain of salt. In 1961, was when Ansel Keyes brought national attention to lipids and their role in human health, he was hailed as Time Magazine's Man of the Year.
and the discussion took center stage of the nutrition conversation. The Heart Health cover stories have reflected a consistent fascination with fats, but they have delivered a completely inconsistent message. Cholesterol, and now the bad news, was a cover story in 1984 arguing eating cholesterol is bad for you. But by 2014, Time reported an article entitled Ending the War on Fat that doctors were now suggesting butter is okay. What or who are we supposed to believe? In my view, we should only listen to the group of people who actually spend their careers studying fat, lipid scientists, who focus solely on learning more about various lipids, fats, and their respective roles in human health. In the decades we've been trying our different kinds of fats in different combinations, from RIP Escaltine's near zero fat engine 2 diet to the South Beach diet, only fish and plant-based dietary fats, to Atkins' emphasis on animal fats, the American public has never heard from a single lipid scientist. That's a real shame, because lipid scientists have plenty to say on the matter. And because they know more on this topic than anyone else, what they have to tell you could save your life.
Just let me grab a drink of water here. I'm getting parched. 1 second here, guys. Give me 1 second. Needed a drink of water. Alrighty, I'm back. Thirsty. Yakking away like this? Okie dokie. Here we go. If there's such a thing as a lipid scientist science rock star, then I would consider Gerard Spittler to be something like Elvis Presley, Jim Morrison, and Mick Jagger rolled into one. Austrian scientists have been quietly getting to the bottom of the role of fats in heart attacks for nearly half a century. A superstar among super geeks whose resume includes teaching and research positions of MIT, Innsbruck, and other prestigious universities, he is a lead author of over 130 published scientific articles. While other members of the lipid research community have studied and written extensively about lipid peroxidation and its potential role in, holy smokes, arteriosclerosis. Wow, that's arteriosclerosis. I don't know if I just read that right, but hey, we'll roll with it. It was Dr. Spittler who, in his 2000 Atherogenesis, definitively points us in the right direction. In this meticulously researched article, Dr. Spittler makes the case that it is processed polyunsaturated fats, not saturated fat or cholesterol, that deserve the blame for the stiffening of arteries throughout the body. We'll learn more about polyunsaturated fats and where they come from later in this chapter. I'm going to guess that until now you've never heard of Dr. Spittler. Lipid scientists are as a rule, don't land their own TV shows. They are not asked to comment on the latest medicinal story on morning news programs. They do not wind up on the cover of Time magazine or in any mainstream magazine. Unlike living the life of a heart surgeon or a brain surgeon or a cardiologist, spending your career in a windowless lab studying fats isn't likely to impress people at a dinner party, synonymous with sexy. This explains why the general public, even though those who study nutrition and health, don't usually get to hear what lipid scientists have to add to the nutrition dialogue, a conversation that, at least lately, largely concerns itself with the good fat, bad fat question. But what about other researchers and medical professionals? Surely, even the jocks in the medical world would take the time to acquaint themselves with the latest findings coming from those lipid researchers who knew far more about fats, how fats behave in the body than anyone else, right?
Wrong. By and large, the guy driving the Porsche Carrera to the surgical suite to thread another stent into another artery of another patient is almost guaranteed to be 30 years or more behind in his knowledge of nutrition and its role in the etiology of the arterial disease that indirectly paid for his house, his upcoming trip to Italy, and his children's Ivy League college educations. In fact, by the time you finish reading this chapter, it's likely you'll know far more about the causes of heart disease than your local heart surgeon or cardiologist. You'll understand what lipid scientists have been telling us and what the research has supported for years. Cholesterol and saturated fat are not your heart's enemy. Industrial fat products like vegetable oils are. Industrial fat products like vegetable oils are toxic to your arteries because they contain delicate polyunsaturated fatty acids, PUFAs, P-U-F-A-F, like PUFAs, that are particularly prone to oxidative damage, especially when exposed to heat and when separated from the antioxidants that would otherwise help protect them from that oxidative damage. I know that's nowhere near as catchy as cholesterol clogs your arteries, but it is what the research evidence supports. So as lipid scientists have long argued, I submit that natural fats and cholesterol have been a part of the human diet for millennia and are not the problem. The historically recent rise in arteriosclerosis and heart disease is the result of a historically recent invention of the food industry. Blind, bleach, and deodorize vegetable oils by revealing how certain fatty acids are changed by heating and processing. Dr. Spittler offers us a chemically indisputable definition of good fats versus bad. Over the rest of this chapter, I'll discuss these concepts and show how eating heat-damaged fatty acids leads to plaque building in your arteries. But first, I want to show you the consequences of Keyes' pet theory and why anyone who vilifies saturated fat is helping to support both the sickness and the junk food industry. How cholesterol theory created a sickness epidemic. In the 1950s, Ansel Keys and others popularized the idea that fat clogs our arteries, the way grease clogs the pipe under the sink. And although the vast majority of all available research tells us this concept is no longer tenable, the medical community, by and large, insists on sticking to that story. True, over the years, we've modified this model a bit, but the central idea is that somehow the body is flawed and unable to deal with natural fats. All of this comes from failing to appreciate the chemical sleight of hand that Dr. Keyes has pulled off when he described his experiments using the term saturated fat while referring to margarine, but everyone thought he was talking about butter. Let's take a moment to look at some of the ongoing consequences of this single misdirection. Prior to Keyes' campaign, people ate far more saturated fat and cholesterol-rich foods than we do today, but heart attacks were so rare that they were almost unheard of. Over the past century, as butter consumption dropped to less than one quarter of what it was, from 18 pounds per person per year to 4, vegetable oil consumption went up fivefold, from 11 pounds per person to 59. In 1900, heart disease was rare. By 1950, heart problems were killing more men than any other disease. Now, at the dawn of the second millennium, heart disease is the number one cause of death in both men and women. Natural fat consumption down. Processed fat consumption up. Heart disease up, way up. Forget for a moment that the experts are saying and ask yourself what these trends suggest to your inner statistician. The next time you go to the grocery store, see how many foods you can find that don't contain vegetable oil as an ingredient. What do you make of the fact that while watching TV at home, you catch a 30-second health spot espousing the benefits of some low cholesterol spread, followed by a commercial for a cholesterol drug, then another one for erectile dysfunction? What does this scenario say to the critical thinker in you? What's been dropping us like flies is not any upsurge in saturated fat consumption, but an upsurge in consumption of two major categories of pro-inflammatory foods, vegetable oils, aka unnatural fats, and sugar. Cutting both from your diet will not only protect your heart, but it will help protect you in all chronic diseases. To help you understand why it's completely unscientific to blame natural fat for heart disease, I will appeal to your inner chemist, showing you why natural fats are beneficial. But first, I want to give you just a little bit of history of these oils and tell you why vegetable oil has managed to work its way into nearly every product that the majority of the Americans eat today. Food manufacturers use vegetable oil for the same reasons other manufacturers use plastic. It is easy to manipulate chemically. The public can be taught to ignore the consequences of its use, and best of all, it's cheap. The first bad fat. In the late 1800s, Emperor Napoleon III offered a prize for a butter substitute to feed his army and the lower classes. The goal was a product that cost very little and wouldn't rot on extended sea voyages. After some experimentation, a chemist named Hippolyte Maigmori found that squeezing slabs of tallow under pressure extracted oily elements that fused into a solid when churned together with skim milk. The dull gray material had a pearly sheen, and so Maigmori called it margarine, after the Greek margaritas, meaning pearl. It didn't taste good, but it was cheap. Not cheap enough for America, however. Rising housing, feeding, breeding, and milking cows is an expensive enterprise compared to growing plants. By the turn of the century, chemists had found a way to reinvent the reinvented butter by starting with material near the bottom of the food chain, cotton seeds. There were sacks and sacks of them lying around without much use. In fact, the tiny black seeds were hard to store because, if left alone, they would ferment and make a terrible stink. Chemists recognized that the odoriferous volatiles, odoriferous volatiles meant the oil was reacting with oxygen, and they smelled opportunity. The reactive nature of the oil meant that it had the potential to be chemically modified for a variety of purposes, and soon enough found a way to spin this worthless byproduct of the textile industry into solid gold. Thus began a happy relationship between chemists, farmers, and petroleum companies that continued to this day. To make the liquid cottonseed oil more like butter, they needed it to thicken into a solid paste. Chemistry offered two options, either tangling bunches of oil molecules together and making the individual molecules less flexible and more stackable. The first option creates a primordial form of plastic, too inedible to pass off as food. So they chose the second option. They engineered a transformation of the fatty acids in the oil, ironing them almost flat with heat, pressure, hydrogen gas, and a nickel catalyst. The key to making the product appear edible was the catalyst, which prevented the molecules from tangling up into plastic. When the oils get squashed flat in this process, their double bonds change from the natural bent flexible configuration to something stiffer, and thus we call particularly hydrogenated fatty acids trans fat after the type of bond that holds the carbon atoms together. Naturally occurring fatty acids contain bonds in a cis configuration. In this configuration, fatty acids are highly flexible, which prevents crystallization or solidification, and so the molecules behave as liquids. Partial hydrogenation does two things. It irons some cis configuration bonds completely flat by saturating the bond with hydrogen and switches others around to trans, converting a cis fatty acid to saturated or trans make it stiffer and more stackable molecule. This is why partially hydrogenated vegetable oils solidify like butter, which contains naturally stiff and stackable saturated fats. Cottolene, which is the first major brand to be successfully marketed in the United States over a century ago. It didn't quite taste like butter, but it was cheap, and the process is still used to make butter for the lower classes today. Now most experts agree that consumption of inexpensive butter substitutes such as margarine and shortening is bad for our health.
Nevertheless, doctors are generally loath to recommend butter to their patients. So what do people use instead? Some of the most dangerous fused products in the store. One of the fundamental concepts of this book is that physical beauty isn't, as it turns out, in the eye of the beholder. Beautiful living things are the manifestations of the immutable laws of natural growth, rules grounded in mathematics. These rules apply everywhere, even at the molecular level. Biomolecules, including fatty acids, cholesterol, and DNA, typically twist into each other, hexagonal or pentagonal configurations to facilitate their interactions with each other and with water. Processing distorts the fatty acids in vegetable oil so they can no longer assume the typical five- or six-sided geometry. Like Chinese finger traps, our enzymes pick up these distorted fatty acids and then can't let them go, which hampers cellular function so profoundly it can kill your cells. And if you eat enough trans fats, cellular dysfunction will impair so many cells and so many tissues that this cumulative effect will disrupt basic functions like blood circulation or your body's ability to fight infection and eventually kill you. Vegetable oils rarely kill children, but they can disrupt normal metabolism so profoundly that a child's dynamic symmetry is lost and their skeletal proportions become imbalanced. No food represents such a full spectrum of molecules from healthy to distorted and extremely toxic as fats. Good fats are some of the best foods you can eat and some of the healthiest, most robust people on the planet and live in cultures whose diets are highly dependent on natural fats, like animal fats. But take those good fat foods away and replace them with foods high in refined carbohydrates and distorted fats, and the same problems we have in our country begin to crop up around the world. Weight gain, heart troubles, mood disorders, other chronic diseases, newborn children exhibiting organ and facial deformation, and other hallmarks of physical degeneration. So far, establishment medicine blames milk and meat. But I blame toxic, distorted fats and sugar. Fortunately, the principle behind avoiding toxic, distorted fats is easy to remember. Eat natural fats and avoid processed ones. This formula works because nature doesn't make bad fats. Factories do. I'm going to give you a list here. How much time do we have left? Holy smokes, only 8 minutes. I'm going to give you the list here of these good and bad fats, and we'll keep reading until as much as we can until we hit to the good ones. These are the ones you're going to want to consume. Olive oil, peanut oil, butter, macadamia nut oil, coconut oil, animal fats like lard or tallow, palm oil. Any artisanally produce unrefined oil. And then you have the bad fats. Canola oil, soy oil, sunflower oil, cottonseed oil, corn oil, grapeseed oil, safflower oil, non-butter spreads, including margarine. See, we're going to have a little bit of an argument over the grapeseed, the safflower, and the sunflower, but they're not as good. So these are the industrial era fats cannot handle the heat involved in processing or cooking. So obviously they're damaged when they're being created, and then if you cook them again, it's not so great. So definitely, if you can prevent it, do not try and cook grapeseed oil, safflower oil, and sunflower oil. Try not to cook those. But these other traditional fats can handle the heat involved in processing or cooking. But, you know, like I said, I'm going to argue those three out of the bad list. And olive oil, in fact, if you cook olive oil, you're going to get the same shit with the moofas and poofas because it's cold pressed and stuff. And if you cook it, you're going to get the same problem. You're going to crispy fry your arteries cooking olive oil just like you would with sunflower or grapeseed oil. So there's that. So just make sure when you're getting your oils, if you really care about your health, you're going to find out how they're processed and you're going to go from there. So, moving on. The seductive flavors of fat-rich foods tempt us for a good reason. Unlike sugar, which offers no nutrition, a meal complete with animal fat actually helps us absorb and taste other nutrients. This is why butter makes other foods taste so delicious, and because animal fats contain cholesterol, a natural appetite suppressant, they satisfy in a way that little else can. In contrast, vegetable oils impair vitamin absorption and do little to suppress more and get less nutrition. When you worry about chemicals hidden in modern food, you might first think of monosodium glutamate, MSG, pesticide residues, and other contaminants like mercury. But compared to bad fats, those are small potatoes. Of the dietary changes attending modernization, nothing compares to what we've done with fats and oils. Over the past 100 years in the United States, our fat intake has gone from largely animal-based and natural to plant-based and so unnatural that our bodies can't adapt. Again, plant-based isn't necessarily bad, but when we're talking about plant-based, we're talking about like margarine and cottonseed oil overly, not so much the other stuff. Thanks to Dr. Keyes and his associates in industry and also the AMA, we have been tricked into questioning our own senses, convinced that our health depends on staying away from once prized and allowing ourselves to be herded into buying tasteless, processed, neutral vegetable oils instead. Without even realizing it, we've traded in on healthy fats for non-toxic ones, and now it's making us sick. So foods loaded with pro-inflammatory fats, don't eat these. Margarine, this is a classic one molecule away from plastic food that backyard animals won't eat. Very little in here other than trans fat and twisted fatty acids that are worse than trans. Don't let kids near it. It interferes with normal bone growth and sexual development. Salad dressing. Aside from water and vinegar, most store-bought salad dressing is pure vegetable oil plus sugar and flavoring agents. Rice milk. One serving contains 1 teaspoon of vegetable oil and just under 1 ounce of liquefied rice. There's nothing else to this stuff except the synthetic vitamins. We tell diabetics not to eat rice, so why would drinking it be a good idea? Soy cheese or soy-based meat products. Processing damages the soybean's cell membrane, releasing PUFAs, which are rapidly oxidizing to harmful omega-trans fats. Whole soy-based meat beans can be part of a healthy diet. And you're going to want to look up traditional Japanese and Chinese diets when it comes to soy, because I'll tell you what, these monsters, they eat soy like it ain't nobody's business, but they don't have the GMO stuff, number one, and number two, they know how to process it appropriately. So if you really like soy, look up traditional Asian diets and get your hands on some soybeans and grow them yourselves. If farmers can do it, so can you, and you won't regret it. Breakfast cereals. Most breakfast cereals are extruded, pressed, flaked, and or puffed. The slurry is then hardened with a coating of vegetable oil, which acts as a protective varnish that can maintain the product's shape and prevent dampness and making it soggy. So we're not going to be able to get through the rest of this tonight. Maybe we'll do some next on next week. We'll have to see what life brings us here next week. Should be done bailing like then, but we'll have to see. Overall, though, as you can see from the stuff that we just read, this is a fairly long chapter. Fairly long chapter. Introduction to how bad our bodies are being damaged over one thing that we're consuming. We're not even talking about the pasteurized dairy. We're not talking about the high fructose corn syrup. We're not talking about the manufactured soy. I mean, we are, but like, you know, so those are my thoughts for the night. We've got about 1.5 minutes left, so I think I'm going to bid you guys adieu. You can find this book. It's called Deep Nutrition, and you can find it on on libgen.is. What's the author's name again? In fact, obviously, if you can buy the book, buy the book. Holy smokes. Thank you. I heard you. Nutrition. Okay, so this book, specifically the whole title of this book is called... No, looks like my computer locked up. Because, you know, 90 seconds. Deep Nutrition, Why Your Genes Need Traditional Food. And this is by Catherine Shanahan, MD. So go get this book. I strongly recommend it. We're going to head out for the evening, guys. And we hope you have a very happy Friday. I will catch you again next week, Friday. And, yeah, stay safe this weekend. Have a good one. Bye.